Welcome to this podcast of articles from the Wall Street Journal, a presentation of AIRS LA. You are listening to this recording, which is provided for the use of those who are blind or print impaired. Materials or items read on AIRS LA are the copyrighted property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Today's first article is titled, "I Finally Learned It's Not So Hard to Throw a Ball," by Sean Shapde. We'll follow that up with an article, "Why Does America's Falling Epidemic Keep Getting Worse?" by Peter Funt. And then Amy Doxer Marcus wrote, "Aging Scientist Races Time, Mental Illness." And we have Bob Green's article, "Crisis and Compassion at 38,000 Feet." All these articles are from recent editions of the Wall Street Journal. So let's begin with today's first article, which is, "I finally learned it's not so hard to throw a ball." When I was 5 years old, my father asked me to play catch for the first and last time. After shielding my face from the oncoming ball, I burst into tears and demanded we do something else. "Sure," he said gently. "Shall we play music or make a pizza?" I'll never forget his forbearance. A gifted athlete himself, he coached Little League softball and soccer, and yet he felt no need to drill his son in the hardy arts of throwing and catching objects. He didn't once push me to try out for either team. My lifelong aphrophobia, which apparently is the correct term for a fear of airborne spheres, accompanying my fear of all things ostentatiously masculine, whether building toy helicopters, wearing backward hats, or peeing in side-by-side urinals. I even found the greeting, "Hey man," to be intimidating. The truth is, I was given to delicate, wholly unrowdy activities. I loved reading, drawing, and playing musical instruments. I reveled in the intangible, especially words. I'd spend my recesses indoors talking to teachers. But despite my father's cool, I couldn't avoid balls. Got worse in high school when boys could throw farther and farther and gym class grew proportionately terrifying. I'd slip to the back of the kickball line one student at a time until the teacher would notice and blow his whistle, forcing me to exhibit my feeble, discoordinated kicks for a snickering crowd of adolescents. Upon graduating high school, I vowed to never again throw, catch, kick, or even touch one of those dreaded circular playthings cherished by men the world over. At this, I succeeded. Well into my 20s, I exercised at gyms or went running daily, but I almost never came into contact with a ball. Then a pandemic swept the world and gyms shut their doors. I found myself doing calisthenic routines at playgrounds and parks. And there, for the first time in a decade, I also found myself in dangerous close proximity to throwers and catchers. Suddenly, balls of all stripes were rolling in my direction. Baseball, tennis ball, basketball, volleyball, soccer ball. Each stray advance was accompanied by a look of expectation. "Hey man, mind tossing it back?" I'd pretend to neither see the ball nor notice its owner's dawning irritation. But I knew how it looked, and I felt as if I were back in high school. Yet, by my late 20s, I learned that I could surprise myself, that I was more powerful and resourceful than long-loge self-conceptions might permit. One drizzly afternoon at a playground in Manhattan, a basketball whirled towards me as I was mid-pull-up. Kid about 10, glanced my way. He had no idea that he loomed as large as an NBA player in my imagination. I knew by then that I had 3 seconds back. I let go of the bars and walked over to the sinister orange orb. I picked it up. Felt lighter than I remembered. I rolled it back. Not quite hard enough. Kid had to walk a few steps to get it, but he nodded appreciatively at me, and I felt a rush of affiliation. Maybe this wasn't so hard after all. On that day, I made a small but weighty pledge of self-reformation. From then on, I would roll back the balls. Soon I was dribbling, even throwing them. And even when I failed to send one on an efficient or accurate course, I was met only with those gloriously fraternal nods of approval. Had the world changed? Had I? Either way, I felt like I'd earned re-entry into the gruff cabal whose code word had eluded me since I could walk. Maybe I'd never even known it. This summer, while visiting my sister at her farm in Virginia, I picked up a stick and threw it as far as I could. "Since when do you throw?" she asked as we watched her dog run after it. I shrugged and didn't answer. Just one of the boys. And now, why does America's falling epidemic keep getting worse? More than one in four people over age 65 fall every year. Earlier this month, the veteran TV host and comedian Jay Leno was one of them. Leno, 74, left his hotel near Pittsburgh looking for a bite to eat. It would have been a long walk to the restaurant, so he took a shortcut down a grassy hill. A tumble on the slope left him with a broken wrist and significant bruises to his face and entire left thigh. Leno still managed to do his comedy act that night. He was luckier than many fall victims. Every year, falls among older Americans result in about 3.6 million emergency room visits and 1.2 million hospital stays at a cost of roughly $80 billion. Nationwide, 41,000 senior citizens die from falls annually, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. In recent years, prominent figures such as comedian Bob Saget, former Connecticut Senator Joe Lieberman, and Ivana Trump died after a fall. And despite progress in care and prevention techniques, a University of Michigan study found that the number of falls goes up about 1.5% every year. It could be that efforts aren't working, or that they are, by mitigating even worse potential injury risk in the population, said Jeffrey Hoffman, a gerontologist at the University of Michigan. Either way, more investment in prevention and funding for fall education and prevention programs would help. The CDC operates a program known as STEADY, Stopping Elderly Accidents, Deaths, and Injuries, to assist healthcare providers in screening older patients for fall risk factors, such as a history of falls, vision problems, inadequate vitamin D intake, and foot problems. In one common test, the patient must get up from a chair, walk 10 feet, turn around, walk back, and sit down. If this takes more than 12 seconds, they are deemed to be at risk for a fall. Earlier this year, Representative Carol Miller of West Virginia, a Republican, introduced legislation to make fall risk assessment part of Medicare's annual wellness benefit for all seniors. The bill would also direct the Department of Health and Human Services to report annual statistics about falls to Congress. "I'm a senior myself," Miller told me soon after her 74th birthday. "You fall, you hurt yourself, you go to the hospital. I had a neighbor who recently fell on a ladder in the kitchen and hit their head and their hip, and they're off and still in the hospital. It's a tough thing. Americans are aging." CDC data show a wide disparity among states in terms of frequency of falls. In Alaska, over 38% of seniors suffer falls each year, with South Dakota next at 34%. When it comes to the risk of death from falling, Wisconsin has the highest rate, with 176 fatalities annually per 100,000 residents over age 65. Minnesota and South Dakota are next at 140. Illinois has the lowest incidence of falls at 20%, followed by Connecticut and Hawaii at 21%. Jennifer Fidenzo, a professor of physical therapy at the University of Arkansas, who studies falls among older Americans, notes that the states with the lowest level of physical activity have the worst rates of falls. Or if people are doing more activity, they potentially will be at a lower risk. Nationally, the death rate from falls jumped 41% from 2012 to 2022, the latest period for which statistics are available. Among seniors, the contributing factors for falls are frustratingly complex. Reaction to prescription drugs, impaired vision, and even such basic things as loneliness or ill-fitting shoes often add to the risk of falling. There has been more research on dual tasks, like doing more than one thing at a time, Vincenzo notes. It's hard for you to focus on movement if you're focusing on doing another task, talking on a phone or texting, so that if you have impaired balance or walking problems, you're not going to pay attention to that and potentially fall. The National Council on Aging advises older Americans to take a free online risk survey. Seniors should also review medication with regards to possible impact on stability, acquire a medical alert device if affordable, and create a home safety checklist, which can include getting rid of small throw rugs, adding a bathroom nightlight, avoiding shelves that are too high to reach safely, and installing grab bars. Vincenzo studies indicate that only half of older adults follow recommendations after getting a fall prevention screening. Predictably, she found that those who didn't suffered higher rates of falls. Many falls among older Americans go unreported, but documented incidents total about 14 million a year. One case involved a 75-year-old woman in Salinas, California, who fell in her bedroom and remained on the floor, unable to stand until her son arrived for a visit some 16 hours later. Following a lengthy hospital stay, her family got her a monitoring device from the medical alert company Lifeline, one of several firms in what has become a $4 billion industry. Recently, the woman fell again, leaving her with a severely fractured arm. This time, the device she was wearing around her neck sensed the fall and automatically triggered a message to a dispatcher via telephone landline. Within seconds, the dispatcher's voice came through a speaker addressing the woman by her first name. Fire department rescue unit was contacted and responders were able to enter the house using a key in the lockbox supplied as part of Lifeline's $48 monthly service. It's been literally a lifesaver, said the woman, who lives alone following her husband's death. Lifeline has now introduced a totally wireless option that allows users to use the fall detection system anywhere in the United States. The market for standalone mobile and landline medical alert system is expected to increase to $4.6 billion this year, reflecting annual growth of more than 12%. Turning to a bit of self-deprecation with following his recent fall, Jay Leno quipped, "The great thing about this age is you don't learn from your mistakes. You just keep doing the same stupid thing." That's exactly what healthcare experts hope to change through education, testing, and behavior modification. As Vincenzo warned, the highest risk factor for having a fall is having had a fall. And now, aging scientist races time, mental illness. Dr. Edward Skolnick figures he needs 5, maybe 10 more years to solve one of the brain's greatest mysteries. Skolnick, 84 years old, has spent most of the past 2 decades working to understand and find better ways to treat schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, mental illnesses suffered by tens of millions of people, including his son. "I know I can crack it," said Skolnick, a noted drug developer who spent his career plumbing the building blocks of DNA for new treatments. Long before his latest quest, Skolnick spent 22 years at Merck, mostly as head of the drug giant's laboratory research. He led development of more than 2 dozen medicines, including the first approved statin to lower cholesterol, an osteoporosis treatment, and an anti-HIV therapy. He was also the company's chief scientist during the development and rollout of Merck's pain reliever, Vioxx, back in 1999. Researchers in a published study later estimate that tens of thousands of people died from heart attacks after taking the drug before Merck pulled it off the market in 2004. The company paid $4.85 billion to settle lawsuits with people who claimed they were injured by the drug. Skolnick stepped down as head of Merck's research lab in 2002. He told friends he wanted to spend the rest of his working life searching for better psychiatric treatment. Skolnick believed advances in genetic technologies would lead to the unraveling of even conditions as complex as schizophrenia, which brings hallucinations and delusions, and bipolar disorder, which causes extreme mood swings. Discoveries in the years since show he was on the right track. In 2021, Skolnick learned that a group of scientists analyzing DNA from thousands of people with schizophrenia had found mutations in 10 genes that substantially increased the risk of developing the illness. They estimated that a mutation on a single gene called SETDLA raised the risk 20-fold. "It got my blood boiling," Skolnick said. He began pursuing an emerging class of treatment called LSD1 inhibitors, hoping to develop a new drug. Skolnick enlisted Dr. Hugh Young Reinhoff Jr., who recently developed an LSD1 inhibitor to treat blood disorders. Skolnick hopes the work will lead to the first approved drug to help with cognitive symptoms, such as trouble paying attention and making plans for people with schizophrenia. Cognitive decline from disease robs people of the ability to hold jobs and manage daily lives. Reinhoff anticipates testing a new drug for safety as early as next year, first in animals. He said he saw Skolnick's passion about fielding a breakthrough treatment, but didn't fully understand why until Skolnick shared about his son's lifelong struggles with mental illness. Jason Skolnick, 54, said his doctor has been regularly fine-tuning his medications for bipolar disorder over the years to minimize their debilitating side effects. Using the drugs currently prescribed for schizophrenia or bipolar disorder, like undergoing chemotherapy, he said. "There's no guarantee it will work and it makes you feel terrible, but the cancer will feel worse or kill you. There remains a long road ahead for any new medicine. It takes more than a decade on average to get a drug from the research lab through government approvals to patients." Ed Skolnick tries to make the most of his days. He walks stiffly to the podium at a meeting of scientists to report on how he landed in LSD1 inhibitors as an avenue for treatment of schizophrenia. Philip Sharp, a Nobel Prize-winning drug developer and professor emeritus at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, was in the audience. Sharp, who has known Skolnick for years, said he was moved that his friend devoted his time and attention to a drug he likely won't see to fruition. Reinhoff said Skolnick has asked him to finish the work if he is no longer around. "This is going to be my last hurrah," Skolnick said. More than 60 years ago, doctors by chance stumbled upon drugs that evolved into treatments for mental illness. Medicines relieved symptoms long before researchers knew how mental illness worked. Lithium, for instance, stabilized moods for people with bipolar disorder, and clozapine tamped down the hallucinations and delusions from schizophrenia. Scientists have since learned that psychiatric disorders can result from interactions among hundreds of genes and still unsolved combinations believed to vary by individuals and within families. To find the gene mutations that carry a higher risk, researchers would have to first compare the DNA of people with mental illness to those without the disease. After leaving Merck, Skolnick was hired back in 2004 by the Broad Institute of MIT and Harvard to lead research on psychiatric disorders. He fostered ties with Ted Stanley, a memorabilia entrepreneur whose son also suffered with mental illness. In 2007, Stanley gave $100 million to launch the Stanley Center for psychiatric research at the Broad, headed by Skolnick for 5 years. In the summer of 2017, the Broad organized an international consortium to harness resources and the latest gene technology that ended up analyzing DNA from more than 24,000 people with schizophrenia and more than 97,000 people without. Sifting for useful clues in realms of data would take years more. Skolnick retired as chief scientist at the Stanley Center back in 2020 for health reasons. He played competitive bridge and awoke early to swim laps. Skolnick visited the Broad for scientific meetings and gave talks. He also spoke regularly with one of the chief investigators of the DNA analysis. 2021, the investigator told Skolnick about the latest research. The SETBLA gene mutation substantially raised the risk of people developing schizophrenia. Skolnick, inspired by the finding, dug into research papers and learned that Takeda Pharmaceutical had developed and tested an LSD1 inhibitor for Kabuki syndrome, a genetic disorder that can cause intellectual disabilities in children. During a visit to Takeda's lab in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and in follow-up video calls, the company shared data with Skolnick that showed improved cognition in mice given the drug. Takeda said it dropped the project after concluding it wasn't a viable therapeutic option. Yet the company's findings convinced Skolnick that a specialized enzyme inhibitor might improve cognitive symptoms without severe side effects. Developing that kind of drug was too big a job for one man alone, Skolnick said, and too expensive. Such a project might cost hundreds of millions of dollars. Then chance intervened. In January 2023, Skolnick heard a talk by Reinhoff, organized by Blackstone, the New York-based investment firm. Skolnick, a senior advisor at Blackstone Life Sciences, wanted to know more about the LSD1 inhibitor Reinhoff developed to treat blood disorders. That same month, Merck completed a $1.4 billion acquisition of Reinhoff's company, Imago Biosciences. Skolnick and Reinhoff had sat together at Blackstone dinner years earlier. During the meal, Skolnick shared stories with his table companions about Merck's development of Crixivan, the anti-HIV drug. I was hearing a piece of history, Reinhoff said, not just HIV history. Skolnick became emotional describing how the drug developers, facing various obstacles, wrestled with whether or not to keep going. He pushed for the study to continue, given the urgency. At that time, AIDS was killing tens of thousands of people a year in the United States. I said that you are thinking like a doctor, not a scientist, Reinhoff said. That was the beginning of our relationship. After Reinhoff's presentation that year, Skolnick learned that Reinhoff was an expert in the enzyme he believed key to a breakthrough drug. In conversation, Skolnick got Reinhoff thinking about using LSD1 inhibitor for schizophrenia and other neuropsychiatric illnesses. When Skolnick raised the idea of developing a new drug, Reinhoff told him he could make one. Reinhoff funded Aluco Biosciences as a first step to make the leap from hematology, his expertise, to neuropsychology. Reinhoff said he has been meeting clinicians and neuroscientists, steeping himself in various theories on the causes of schizophrenia and seeking potential collaborators. Reinhoff has a team of chemists making and testing compounds. I'm optimistic something will come of this, Reinhoff said. I can do it, but I wouldn't have done it if not for Ed. I am really doing this in a way for Ed. Jason Skolnick lives in a light-filled condominium in Watertown, Massachusetts, about a 25-minute drive from his parents. Guitars lean against the wall, and a landscape photo shot by his mother hangs on another. He sometimes watches football games on the big screen TV with his father. His life now contrasts with years of struggle. Jason graduated from Harvard University back in 1992 and worked as a clerk in the economics department of a biotech firm. Before taking the job, he began to feel paranoid. At work, he couldn't look colleagues in the eye. Doctors suspected bipolar disorder and prescribed him medications. They left him so tired he had trouble keeping awake while driving. He missed work, then quit, and moved in with his parents in Philadelphia. Jason's doctors finally found the drug regimen he could tolerate after 2 years of trying. At age 25, Jason returned to Boston to study guitar at Berklee College of Music, but dropped out after less than a year. During those months, he said, his paranoia had returned and he abused alcohol. One night in 1995, Jason said he took pills intending to end his life. He woke up hallucinating and called a friend who dialed 911 for an ambulance. Jason returned to live with his parents in 1966, the same year the Food and Drug Administration approved Merck's anti-HIV drug that his father had helped develop. He tried various medicines over the years, including one drug that landed him in the hospital. They call antipsychotics major tranquilizers for good reason, Jason said. They clamp down on your head, and it's up to you to suck down large amounts of coffee to deal with how they make you feel. Not just tired, but also cognitively impaired. The lack of effective treatment saddened and frustrated his father, who built a career developing drugs for once intractable conditions. Jason, who has been sober now for more than a decade, is in his second year at a master's program at Lesley University, studying to become a clinical mental health counselor and music therapist. He credits his psychiatrist for continuing to help calibrate his drugs and therapy. There's nobody I know who can just take medicine and be fine, Jason said. His father agreed to a point. It won't take some magical drug to fix what people with really severe mental illness have, Ed Skolnick said. But as a parent and scientist, he feels certain new treatments will improve lives. There's a need for better drugs, he said. Others also are on the hunt. Biotech company Orizon Genomics in Spain is developing LSD1 inhibitors for cancer and other conditions. Columbia University researchers tried Orizon's drug in mice and found it reversed cognitive impairments caused by the SETBLA genetic mutation connected to schizophrenia. Dr. Joseph Gogos, who led the Columbia research, said it was possible such treatments would be approved for people. Skolnick is more certain of both the revolutionary new treatment and is living to witness it. Before I die, we will see new medicines, new diagnostics, better outcomes for patients burdened by schizophrenia or bipolar illness, he said. I will not be happy to die, but I will die happy that my life helped. And now let's do one more, crisis and compassion at 38,000 feet. The flight started unremarkably enough if you forget that traveling vast distances at great speeds inside a metal tube miles in the air once seemed an impossible notion. Southwest Airlines Flight 1749, New York LaGuardia to Chicago Midway International departed right on time. Quiet flight, smooth air, and then something happened. There was a stir near the front of the cabin. You can tell when something is amiss. A flight attendant hurried to a row on the left side. The woman seated by the window had lost consciousness. I was two rows behind on the aisle and could see all of this and hear most of it. The flight attendant, I would learn later that her name is Nissa Thabak and that she has worked for Southwest for 24 years, was the same one who had greeted passengers cheerfully as we boarded. Now her face looked serious. She was calm, professional, fully focused. She knelt, speaking to the woman as she regained consciousness. She then hit the call button above the seats. In response, one of her colleagues hastened to her side. He made an announcement on the public address system. Will any medical professional on board please come to the front of the plane? A crew member retrieved the plane's emergency medical kit. Within seconds, a fellow passenger, a physician, was on his knees taking the woman's pulse and going through a checklist of medical queries. she was able to answer. Another man quickly joined him. "I'm an EMT," he said to Ms. Seebach. Seeming satisfied that the physician had things under control, he said, "I'll be back at my seat if you need anything." 38,000 feet in the air, a stranger was in trouble, and these people, without an instant's hesitation, were stepping up to help. In this allegedly fractious world of ours, none of them knew or cared about the other's political beliefs. The woman who fell ill, the flight attendants, the physician, the EMT, were of different ethnicity. They had never met. That mattered not at all. We live in litigious times, but it seemingly didn't occur for a moment to the two medical men that it might have been easier not to get involved. Someone needed them. The woman by the window stabilized, and the physician spoke quietly to Ms. Seebach before returning to a seat. As the flight continued, Ms. Seebach periodically checked on and comforted the woman. When things go wrong in this world, it makes the front pages. When things go right, when people come through for each other, it's not considered news. Flight 1749 landed in Chicago, and we all disembarked into an America that we are constantly told is angry and full of distrust. That brings us to the end of today's articles. I'm Merrick Schneider, and I'll be back soon with more articles. Thank you for listening.